trust of its citizens is by telling the truth. There is no other way, no shortcut.
And I call upon our government to open up like the Belgians have, the French have, Brazilians have, the Argentines, the Mexicans have all released their files. It's about time now that we do the same thing and become a part of this planetary community.
It is way past time for all of us to know what our own government knows, instead of being kept in the dark by a policy of ditto.
The last time the Congress held a hearing addressing the extraterrestrial issue was 1968, 44 years of sightings ago. In those 4.5 decades, hundreds of thousands of new sightings have taken place. Government agency witnesses have come forward. Media coverage has expanded. Hundreds of documentaries have been produced, thousands of books have been written, and yet the United States Congress has remained silent. So for a period of 5 days, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C., 2 blocks from the White House, 12 blocks from the Congress of the United States, we're going to conduct a citizen hearing on disclosure of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. 40 to 50 witnesses of high rank and station, from military, from agencies, possibly from intelligence services, along with the top researchers in the world, will give 30 hours of testimony to 5 former members of the United States Congress.
So maybe a citizens' hearing has a chance to try to leverage open some of the truth about the fact that we're not alone in this universe, that we might actually begin to look at what we really are, what the true history of this planet is. And that might be what gets us into a future without self-destruction.
The motto of the citizen hearing is, if Congress won't do its job, the people will.
Greetings, everybody. This is Beth. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable, Countdown to Disclosure. Hi, everybody. How are you doing today? It's great to see you here. Today, what I'd like to do is share with you something that was considered various issues. I thought this was the little gems of the hearing that were kind of lumped together and were outside of the other header topics. So, check this out. Enjoy.
Worked in both the public and the private sector. Have a very good education, and I think the committee has a one-page biographical statement on my background. Have an educational background.
This is Peter Davenport.
Genetics, international business. I am a former Russian translator.
He runs the National Reporting Center for UFOs.
June of 1979, I qualified as an escort interpreter for the U.S. Department of State. I've spent many years teaching at the university level. I'm a businessman, former founding president of a successful biotech firm in Seattle. So I'm probably not construed to be, or cannot be construed to be, some kind of unusual, quirky person. And I speak within that context. It's important to create the context so you can understand what I'm discussing this morning. Let me move to the second phase of what I'd like to present, and that is the National UFO Reporting Center. Founded, as I mentioned earlier, in October 1974 by my predecessor as director in that capacity. His name is Robert J. Gribble, a retired Seattle fireman who had a lifelong interest in the subject of UFOs. And in July of 1994, he turned over the reins to me, and I think I can honestly report to the committee that it's changed my life and changed my outlook on what reality may be. The UFO Reporting Center has a hotline, rings 24 hours a day. We also have a website, ufocenter.com, where over the course of the last 19 years, I've accumulated approximately 86,000 written reports. I estimate that that represents roughly one-third of the reports that have been submitted to our center. What I would like to do, and my gratitude to Congressman Bartlett. He gave me a wonderful opportunity yesterday when he made his, I think, commendable statement alluding to the press and the perceived lassitude there and how they behave with regard to the issue of ufology. What I would like to do, Mr. Chairman, with the remainder of my time is walk through a 6-page document that I've submitted to the committee and respond to the question that Mr. Bartlett posed, certainly rhetorically and perhaps tacitly yesterday: where is the press? Where are all the reports? And my hope is in about 7 or 8 minutes, the committee will understand a little bit better the reality, the apparent reality that we are dealing with in addressing the issue of UFOs. If the committee could please turn to page 1 of the document listing a number of reports. Out of deference to the chair, I would like to start with a report from the state of Alaska from the year 1936. And this goes back to a question that Congressman Cook posed, I believe, in the late morning of Monday of this week. He said, where are all the reports from past years? And I'd like to address that. Aklutna, Alaska, October 1936, two teenage boys working in that city of Alaska at that time, no doubt a small city, were employees of the CCC, Civilian Conservation Corps, building a camp there. They decided to hitchhike into Anchorage, Alaska. As they were walking towards Anchorage, hoping to get a ride into that city, they encountered an object that looked roughly something like a flat iron. Mr. Holger Berg, one of those teenagers, reported to me in September of year 2000. They were walking towards Anchorage. They noticed a light coming directly at them. They were relieved because it was cold in October of that year, and they thought it was a truck with only one headlight. Lo and behold, it turned out allegedly to be something else. It was a triangular craft that passed right overhead, scared them so badly that they dove into a snowbank to get away from it. Next case, McMinnville, Tennessee. Questions have been posed before this committee, and the committee has commented, do UFOs ever crash? Do they have malfunctions? On the 7th of January, 1995, precisely that seems to have occurred over the city of McMinnville, Tennessee. A fleet of objects seen descending over the airport in McMinnville for several minutes. One of them appears to have blown up. Tonight, during my longer presentation at 9 p.m., I will show the 5-page handwritten document prepared by an investigating officer of what happened there. If the committee would please turn to page 2, I'd like to, for a moment, address the issue of the Phoenix Lights case. Quite a celebrated case, probably the most dramatic UFO event that has occurred in the history of ufology since 1947. Just briefly, the 5 objects that loitered over the city of Phoenix for upwards of 2 hours were not less than 7 miles in diameter. I will present evidence tonight showing why we believe that is the case and how we calculated the size of them. Next case. Longview, Washington. An elk, an adult female elk, lifted out of the forest of the state of Washington before 14 witnesses at about 1 minute before noon. We have reported that. I've had witnesses on multiple radio programs talking about that case. Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, October 26, 1999. Two airline pilots over the Dallas-Fort Worth area were shocked to see a large disc approaching their aircraft. It suddenly turned, executed, they estimated, a 120-degree turn in under 1 second. It streaked away from them to the east. We have the audio tape from the FAA through a Freedom of Information Act request. If the committee would please turn to page 3. About two-thirds of the way down that page, Challis, Idaho, September 27th, year 2000, 2130 hours mountain time. 4 hunters were in a remote hunting camp near Challis, Idaho, about an hour and a half drive outside that city. one of the men exited the trailer that they were in to secure food for dinner that night. He was shocked by what he saw hovering above their camp, a triangular craft, dark. His flashlight, as he jumped up on the back end of his pickup truck, swept across the sky. What he saw above him shocked him so badly that he fell to his knees and started yelling. Three of the others in the trailer came out, and they observed the object suddenly, slowly move off, go up the side of a nearby mountain range, go over the top of it. A very dramatic case, and if the committee would like documentation of that case, I would call upon Mrs. Howe at the end of the table, who was present at the testimony of two of those witnesses. She later brought them to a radio program. Next case I would like to address briefly is that of Carteret, New Jersey, on the top of page 4. Very dramatic case in which certainly dozens, possibly hundreds of cars were parked on the New Jersey Turnpike in response to a cluster of yellow objects that were hovering above that turnpike. Just seconds earlier, they had been reported from Fort Dix, New Jersey, to be streaking across that military facility. Within seconds, they were probably 70 or 80 miles to the east, and it was reported by many hundreds of people. Moving down further on page 4, the location, Andrews Air Force Base, Waldorf, Maryland. Mr. Richard Dolan first alluded to this case on the morning of Monday this week. A blue object, there's an error in this citation. I think Mr. Dolan reported it accurately, however. A blue object seen streaking over Waldorf, Maryland on that date, July 26th, year 2002, in being pursued by two F-16 fighters. Minutes later, it was seen returning the opposite direction, also pursued by those same fighters. A very, very interesting case. The case below it, Meriwether County, Georgia, April 13th, 2003. Three people driving in a closed vehicle. The driver was shocked to see a cluster of red objects pursuing his vehicle. Suddenly, those tiny objects, perhaps the size of golf balls, allegedly, reportedly, were inside his vehicle. They stayed in the vehicle for an estimated 20 to 30 seconds. Suddenly, all of them coalesced around one of the occupants of the vehicle, the older brother of the two brothers. This gentleman had had intestinal surgery just a few days earlier, had a colostomy. All of the objects in the car assembled around the surgical scar on the lower abdomen of this gentleman. Within seconds, they suddenly streaked off, interestingly, through the closed windows of the vehicle. I've had those three witnesses on an international radio program talking about their experience. If the committee could please turn to page 5, Seattle, Washington, June 20th, 2004, an adult male standing outside the University District of Seattle was shocked to see a triangular craft suddenly streak across the cloudless blue sky. Very, very dramatic sighting. Others reported it to the National UFO Reporting Center. That case has been on our website for the last 13 years. Going down to a case at the bottom of page 5, the O'Hare Airport case of November 7, 2006. Mr. Dolan, Richard Dolan, alluded to this case earlier in the week's testimony. A very, very dramatic case. A disc estimated to be some 30 to 40 feet in diameter, hovering above gate C-17 at O'Hare Airport, seen for perhaps as long as 10 minutes or even longer. I cite the case because of the drama surrounding it. That object was in what used to be called terminal control airspace, now called Class B airspace. Nothing should have been there over that airport. And it was suddenly seen to accelerate, as Mr. Dolan reported earlier in the week. It punched through two layers of solid overcast, leaving holes in the overcast, a very interesting and dramatic case reported on national news, interestingly. Turning to the last page, if we could please, page 6. Chicago, Illinois, November 4th, year 2008. I will be presenting evidence on this case to include photographs of the very peculiar damage that a young woman's car sustained. We cannot demonstrate clearly or to everybody's satisfaction that the case is UFO related, but I will present the evidence tonight during my presentation at 9 p.m. Very, very interesting case of the mutilation of a car. I will leave it at that until I'm able to show the photographs. I'd like to close by citing a number of interesting cases that have been submitted to our center over the last roughly 10 months. We all are questing to know what all of this means and what's going on. The phenomenon appears to be very real. But in June of last year, 2012, the National UFO Reporting Center began receiving reports that I certainly do not understand. I don't believe anybody does, but the second week of June last year, and all of this information can be seen on the website, ufocenter.com, we started receiving reports, credible reports from credible witnesses of clusters of red, orange, yellow, amber, or gold lights, up to 150 in a cluster from around the world. I've written several articles. We have several statements on our homepage about this phenomenon. It's very interesting, and in my opinion, it may represent the fact that we may have rounded the corner, so to speak, in the field of ufology when it comes to the dramatic nature of many of the reports that are coming to us. What the cause of these sightings is, we have no idea. But we have roughly 2,000 to 3,000 of these sightings posted to our website. If members of the committees would like to see details, I would commend to their attention the roughly 38 cases that were submitted to our facility on Saturday night, the 10th of November, year 2012. One of those cases on page 6 of your handout is that of Castle Rock. I cite that case because it was a report that was submitted to our center by a commercial airline pilot, retired, 37 years of experience, driving east from Interstate 5. This is about 70 miles north of the city of Portland. Driving east on Highway 504, what he saw frightened him so badly that he stopped his car on the highway, turned it around, and went back the other direction to get his camera and his wife. It's a very, very dramatic case. Again, one of roughly 38 cases. An hour and 12 minutes later, a retired United States Marine Corps officer and his wife encountered something very similar in the city of Los Angeles. So in conclusion, Mr. Chairman and ladies and gentlemen, the question has been posed, is the UFO phenomenon real? And I pose to you the question that if it is not real, why have all of these reports been submitted over the last roughly 19 years? The UFO phenomenon appears to be very real. And I would like to conclude in responding to the very prescient question that Congressman Bartlett posed yesterday at about 3:05 p.m. Where is the press and where are all of the reports? Very good question, and it's a question that every serious-minded UFO investigator poses it to himself probably multiple times a day. I'd like to address the issue of the press. Many people have asked the question, why is the press responding apparently so strangely to this phenomenon? And from my vantage point, it's really a little bit different than that. I would split the press into two categories at least, the local, regional press and the national press. From my observation, and I've had hundreds of exchanges of information with members of the press, the interesting phenomenon is members of the local or regional press are questing for this data. A week doesn't go by when I don't get 3 to 5 queries from members of the local press, smaller newspapers, radio and television stations. But interestingly, when one gets to the national level, the interest seems to simply expire. A very peculiar phenomenon, but it tells us that people who are professional writers, who are professional reporters, are very interested in this phenomenon. And I close with a brief comment about the government's apparent position on this phenomenon. The government knows about this phenomenon. There is no doubt about it. I've had multiple exchanges, multiple conversations with all sorts of people who are in positions of authority in federal, state, and local government. Many of them admit that they accept the fact that this is potentially a very real phenomenon. I've talked to military officers, senior officers, general or flagship officers, flag officers, who in quiet conversations have admitted to me that they are very interested in this phenomenon, and in their opinion, there is very real evidence in support of what this committee is addressing in these hearings this week. It appears that we are being visited on a frequent basis. The evidence supports it strongly, in my opinion. And with that, I will close. I think my time has expired.
Thank you very much. It has expired. Thank you. I want to underscore a different style from my personal point of view. I do not intend to interrupt any of the speakers. You're aware of the time and when it goes over, and your testimony is very good, it'll continue. However, you have to self-discipline yourself. And in case you have problems with that, you just look at me, and when I'm doing it like that, that means wind it up intelligently so that you look good. And I want to commend you, Mr. Davenport. You have a great political style, and that is when you're going over, you repeat that you're going to close in about 3 or 4 times.
I do apologize, Mr. Chairman. I should have noticed the time card, and I was so focused on...
You stay focused. Stay focused on your message. We'll worry about the time. But we appreciate your testimony. Mr. Robbins, the floor is yours, and we'll allow you the same latitude. But keep in mind that when we're biting into time, we're biting into our time to question you and to have a discourse that may be more germane to our particular interest. So discipline yourself. Mr. Robbins, please go forward, and I won't interrupt you.
Mr. Chairman. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, distinguished members of our committee. I also want to take a moment and thank Stephen Bassett for giving me the honor of offering testimony here this morning. I was only scheduled here to do this yesterday afternoon, so my opening statement is a bit rough at the edges. I've been involved in the field of UFO studies for more than 30 years. As a researcher, lecturer, activist, consultant, author, and conference organizer. I've consulted to numerous television and radio shows, films, appear on radio regularly commenting about these subjects, write a column, a new one that will be starting in June for a new online magazine called UFO Truth, published by my friend and colleague to my right, Gary Haseltine. I'm also the co-author of a 540-page book that was a bestseller in the United Kingdom, entitled Left at East Gate, a firsthand account of the Rendlesham Forest UFO investigation, the Rendlesham Forest UFO incident, its cover-up and investigation. For these 30 years that I have pursued this subject, I have done it on a number of fronts, always doing my utmost to approach each new case, witness claim, research paper, or interview, free of prejudice or agenda. My only objective being to get myself and my readers as close as possible to the truth of what I've been looking into. limited only by my investigative skills, means, and applying as much common sense as possible wherever possible. Before proceeding, however, I feel I should go on, put on the record that I am self-trained as an investigative writer. And if anyone in these hearings has a background more opposite than my friend and colleague Peter Davenport, it's me. I began my professional life as a painter and film historian. I taught painting in New York City for many years at my alma mater, the School of Visual Arts. And as I developed as a writer, I supported myself, continuing as an artist, as a manager of a distinguished repertory theater company in New York City, as a New York City tour guide, and as a copywriter. I also worked for 8 of those years as an online phone volunteer and shift supervisor on the busiest crisis intervention and suicide hotline in the United States. Some may feel that such an eclectic and decidedly unrelated background may not be much of an asset in the field I ultimately choose to pursue. I can only beg to differ. Subjects I've chosen to investigate have included, but not been limited to, the origins of the UFO ridicule factor, roadblocks on the path to disclosure, the United Kingdom's Rendlesham Forest incident, the strange death of James Vincent Forrestal, first Secretary of Defense, as some of you know, and an early casualty of UFO secrecy, at least that are my conclusions. Critical thinking, deductive reasoning and ufology, stress and UFO studies, the UFO abduction phenomena, and UFOs, organized religion, and fundamentalist thinking. As this morning's discussion topic is listed as various topics, I believe I qualify. While I stand ready to try and answer any questions to the best of my ability this committee may have, I'd particularly like to invite you to focus in on two of these particular areas of study. One, the so-called UFO ridicule factor. We now know for a fact the subject of UFOs and their implications have been regarded as extremely serious by our military and intelligence communities from at least the summer of 1947 on. More seriously, in fact, than any other matter facing this nation since the end of World War II. Why then have the overwhelming majority, and Mr. Davenport hit the nail on the head, we divide the media's general relationship with the subject of UFOs into two areas. Local and regional news gatherers are overall very serious, inquisitive, and genuinely respectful of this mystery. Major media has singled this subject out for a level of ridicule, sarcasm, and condescension matched in post-war journalism. How and why did all of this come to pass, and what is its legacy for the American people? The second subject is one you were introduced to during yesterday morning's hearings. That is the UK's Rendlesham Forest UFO incident. I first heard of these events in the autumn of 1983, shortly after the story broke in Great Britain. The following year, I met and chatted briefly with Larry Warren, the former United States Air Force security police officer who had, completely on his own, and to a degree at great risk, certainly to his peace of mind and character, become the whistleblower in this case, was directly responsible for the FOIA that resulted in the release of Colonel Halt's January 1981 report, which was then published in England in 83, and the story broke. 4 years later, we met again at a conference not far from here at American University in Washington. I was very impressed with his presentation. Fully authentic military witnesses who can be fully vetted and prove their involvement are not all that common. You've had the privilege of hearing several of them yesterday afternoon. I decided I wanted to interview this guy. He decided, after hearing me on a panel discussion, he wanted me to co-author a book with him. We met the next weekend, talked all weekend, and by that Sunday afternoon, we shook hands, and I was very excited. I was going to be writing a book. I was looking for a serious project to get my teeth into. I thought it might take a year or two. Obviously result in a huge bestseller, a movie deal, many checks to endorse, and women to fight off. Life does not always work out the way you think. The book took 10 years to complete. It cost us everything we had. It cost me to a great degree my peace of mind. It's brought me back to England since more than 20 times. I had no idea what I was getting into. But when we completed it, it was a bestseller in the United Kingdom. It was immediately in the library of the then new Prime Minister, Tony Blair. One of our greatest champions in the United Kingdom became former Admiral of the Fleet, former Chief of Staff of the Ministry of Defense, Lord Peter Hill Norton, who as an MP brought his hardcover copy onto the book of the floor of House of Lords and confronted the then Secretary for Defense with four questions taken right out of the book, all of which were demurred. When my co-author lost his passport, the State Department refusing to renew it, for quote-unquote speaking out on sensitive defense issues in a public forum on foreign soil, it was nobody less than former Attorney General Ramsey Clark, who pro bono helped us restore Larry's passport and continue our work. The men who were involved in this as witnesses, and it was only touched on yesterday, were put through absolute hell. Some of the things that were done to them were unconscionable as far as I'm concerned, and this is of more interest and focus for me than whatever the source of the intelligence is behind the events of December 1980. I applaud John and Jim for fighting for the truth to come out about this. I think all of these men are still struggling. And in fact, we are all clear in former deputy base commanders, Charles Hall's terminology, that these men were meddled with. And in some cases are still sorting out implanted memories from actual ones. Hence comes a certain amount of contention within this case that continues 33 years after. I hope I could clarify some of it if asked. And again, thank you for the privilege of appearing before you.
Your timing is excellent, Mr. Robbins. Next witness is Gary Hazeltine.
Hazeltine. Thank you. Good morning, and I will not go over 10 minutes, I promise. Right, my name is Gary Hazeltine, and I am a recently retired police detective in England, having served almost 24 years with the British Transport Police. For the majority of that time, for 20 years, I was a detective. I was dealing at the sharp end of evidential matters. I've been involved in murder, manslaughter, rape, etc., etc. I come to this subject on an evidential basis, and I think that is very necessary in this field. I am here principally to speak on behalf of police officers worldwide who have witnessed UFOs, but I would also like to say that I'm also one of the principal investigators of the Rendlesham Forest incident that my colleague Peter has alluded to, along with Linda Moulton Howe. I would consider us the three principal investigators of this incident. We're all doing very good work on it. For the last 5 years, I have worked with Colonel Charles Holt, the man who wrote the Holt Memorandum, the deputy base commander on what was absolutely a nuclear facility. And let me back that up by saying that for 3 years of my 6 years in the Royal Air Force, between 1983 and 1989, I served on two nuclear bases doing exactly the same job as what those US Air Force policemen did. And the base at Bentworth is identical to the base that RAF Ladbrokes in West Germany, where I worked. Let's cut the crap. This is a nuclear issue. Right. In January 2002, moving to my police background, I created the Police Reporting UFO Sightings Database. It's commonly referred to as the Pruforce Police Database. You have an information pack with that information. It's basically there for UK police officers to record on and off-duty police sightings. Believe me, over the 11 years of my research, nothing will surprise me what anybody says in this field about what they report. It is truly extraordinary. When I began my research 11 years ago into British police officers, there were approximately six cases involving 10 officers. 11 years later, I now have over 425 cases involving over 940 British police officers. This is a significant amount, in my opinion. These sightings have taken place the length and breadth of Britain and have been reported at all times of the day. Whilst I'm not a big lover of statistics because they can be manipulated, I would say that the key statistic for me is that over 70% of these cases are multiple witness officer cases. Therefore, it is significant corroboration to a sighting event. Again, I look at this case through evidential eyes. In one particular case, there is in excess of 24 police officers that were involved in tracking at least one object over six counties of Britain on the night of March the 30th, 31st, 1993. This is referred to as the Cosford incident. Many police officers have observed structured craft of huge size and proportions in close proximity to their ground positions. These craft range in shape and size and dimensions from many tens of feet to many hundreds of feet in size. Many of the police cases on the database, in my opinion, are truly extraordinary. For example, in October 1984, near RAF Northolt in Middlesex, a silent black triangular object was seen at low altitude by two uniformed police officers on mobile patrol, which they described as being the size of three football fields. When I sought to clarify this description of size, they said when they saw it, it was above three football fields. So I think that's a pretty good representation of size. This report was made by Police Constable Robin Perry of the Metropolitan Police. On another occasion in October 1978, three uniformed police officers in a rural area of Buckinghamshire observed a huge object, which they described as a size of a football field, which suddenly and silently materialised in front of them in the blink of an eye and at relative close proximity to their position. However, there were also a number of smaller objects flying around the large main object, akin to a mothership kind of scenario, and the larger object then projected a beam down to the ground, which was the width of the football field, which then traversed the ground as if scanning the terrain for several minutes. They watched for this event for approximately 5 minutes before suddenly it went off and dematerialized in the blink of an eye. 1 second it was there, and then it was gone. And this has been described as like switching on a light bulb on and off. Not something that I think our stealth capabilities are capable of yet. The source of that report is the Police Constable Eric Raymond, retired of the Thames Valley Police. Many officers have seen objects that appear to move in ways that seem to defy our laws of known physics and aerodynamics. For example, in May 1981 and 1982, two firearms officers were involved in the close protection of what was then a very prominent Conservative minister in a rural location in North Yorkshire. At approximately 5:30 hours in the morning, as they were walking in the grounds of this residence, they suddenly became aware that the sunshine had darkened, the sky had darkened. When they looked up to establish the cause of that, they were amazed to see a huge, dark, purple, cylindrical object with a pronounced undercarriage underneath it that was described as being the length of the football field, a common figure in all of this, and hovering silently above the house at an altitude of only 200 to 300 feet, which is extremely close. The object remained motionless, silent, above the house for 5 to 10 minutes before it suddenly and silently accelerated in the blink of an eye out to the horizon, where it stopped in an instant for a few seconds and then disappeared towards the horizon and out of sight. The source of this report is Police Sergeant retired John Pawson of the North Yorkshire Police. In my introduction, I mentioned that I would refer to police officer sightings worldwide. And in the time permitted, I would like to draw your attention to just two particular countries where numerous police officer sightings have taken place. Namely, I refer to the United States and Belgium. Many of the US cases are simply outstanding, and I will highlight just two of them. just after midnight on the 14th of December 1994, 15 police officers of Trumbull County, Ohio, observed multiple circular UFOs from different geographical positions. In one particular sighting, the engine of the police vehicle driven by Sergeant Toby Malaro suddenly cut out. When he got out of the vehicle, he looked up and a UFO was...